Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our third and final share, exploring the challenge of navigating meat and dairy in our ovens, in our kitchens nowadays. And what we saw in the first week was broadly a sketch of the general fundamental principles at the heart of kitchen kashrut, which is the concern of netinat ta'am, of almost contamination, that again, when you stick the spoon into the chicken soup, the spoon absorbs the chicken soup absorbs the spoon, and therefore if that spoon is dairy, problems arise. What we saw was that, nonetheless, that requires contact. The assumption always is that when it comes to kashrut issues, the meat and the dairy or the two items need to be making contact with one another. And that was not the case when we picture the way our ovens work. If you have, again, your tray of uncovered mac and cheese and you have your tray of brisket and you put the two of them in your oven next to one another, they ain't making contact with one another. What could possibly be the problem? And we saw last week, we looked at this in far greater detail, the issue raised by the Gemara. We will see the source once again for other reasons today, but the issue raised by the Gemara is that of Recha. This is indeed a debate, but within the Gemara itself, but there is potentially concern that the aroma of the foods, they kind of impact, they contaminate each other. And that potentially is a problem, though, as we saw, in truth, it's not a hard problem to avoid. Or to put this another way, it is seemingly very, very easy to navigate issues of Recha. And really, the issues are only ever arising when, though we will qualify this a little bit later today, but the issues are only ever arising when the two food items are in the oven at the same time. But that's never been our problem. That's not what we imagine to be our issue. Our issue, our scenario, our situation is when, let's imagine, instead of putting the brisket and the cheese together at the same time, because that's just not something we really do, but you had your brisket cooking in your oven, it's ready, ding, the oven beeps, it's ready, you pull the brisket out, and then you take your tray of mac and cheese and boomf, push it in straight away, what's called za achar za, this after this, literally one straight after the other. That's potentially a far more realistic scenario that we are dealing with. What could possibly be the issue there? And that was where we ended last week. And as I share the screen once again of the source sheet, that we are introduced to a new problem. And that problem is what's known as Zeya, literally steam. So we see the Rama Atz, after giving a whole variety of different reasons why we might need to be concerned with Recha, but also not necessarily too concerned with Recha, the Rama adds, Aval, source number one, Beza achar ze in lachush. We don't need to worry about, you know, foods one after the other. Ela imkein hazeya hamachavat mishnehem. Unless both of the pans emit this zeya, this steam, the az asur afilu b'za achar za. In such a situation, it is prohibited to cook za achar za. What is our concern here? Our concern here is that the steam, the zeya from the brisket being cooked in our ovens is going to rise. And obviously there's no other food in the oven for it to infect, but what it's going to do is contaminate the oven itself. The oven's going to absorb the steam, brisket steam. And then you pull your brisket out, you put in your mac and cheese. And what happens is the heat of the oven causes the zeya, now the brisket steam, to be polate, to emerge from the walls of the oven and thus contaminate the mac and cheese. That ostensibly is our problem. And look, this is, on the one hand, a serious halachic issue. As we saw last week, but just to recap, source number two, this entire notion of zeya, though admittedly there are a couple of sources that potentially suggest other rationales behind zeya, but the most commonly invoked source to prove that Zeir is an issue is the Mishnah in Machshirin, which details a variety of issues concerning liquids. And the Mishnah states, Merchatz Tmea, Zeyata Tmea, that if the bathhouse is impure, the steam also from the bathhouse is impure. In other words, we assume that steam has a contaminating power, a contaminating quality. And the Shulchan Aruch says in source number 3, Machavat Shel Chalav, you have a pan of milk, Shenatnu Bekirata, that you have in your oven, Tachat Kedera Shel Basar, under a pot of meat, Hazea Ole, the steam rises, the Nivla Bikedera, and is absorbed by the pot of meat, the Osarta, and prohibits it. That is the rule, that is the halacha. We therefore see very clearly, unambiguously, two important principles of Zeya. One is, it's real in the sense that it conveys it preserves the state of the item from which it rises. So in the Mishnah, it's tuma, but we can easily extend that to foods. Steam of meat is meat. And second, it absorbs. The Shulchan Aruch says it explicitly. So we seem to have a good reason to now be concerned about our ovens. We cook the brisket in our ovens, that steam is meaty, and it is absorbed into the oven. This seems to be a major problem. It seems to very clearly indicate that our ovens become, for want of a better expression, gendered. The moment something is cooked and covered within them, so you, again, for want of a better expression, you christen your new oven by cooking a brisket, you have now made that brisket meat. And just as all other items in your house are either meat or dairy, just as you have your meat frying pan, your meat pot, and you're never cooking dairy in those things, so too your oven, by the laws of Zeya, seems to work on this very principle. I would say, broadly speaking, on a technical level, what I've just said is true. I'll mention shortly a source which is going to, we're not actually going to look at it inside, but I'll mention a source shortly that will disagree with that premise. But I don't think anything that I've said per se is controversial. However, we still have a major problem. Because if Zeya, steam is halachically significant, meat steam, the steam from meat is meat itself and thus contaminates ovens, and we mentioned this last week, but we should read through it again. Why is Zeya never mentioned in the crucial and really only source discussing the kashrut of ovens in the Gemara in Pesachim? Take a look at source number 4. We've seen this now for 2 weeks in a row, and this makes it the third week, but it's such a crucial source. We need to learn it off by heart. Amar Rav, Basar Shechut HaShamein. You have this fatty kosher meat, Shetzalo im Basar Nevela Kachosh, that you are cooking in the same oven as lean treif meat. Asor, Rav says it's prohibited. My time amit patme mehadadi, they flavor one another. Again, Recha, the aroma flavors each other and creates a problem. The Levi Amar, Levi dissents. Afilu basar shechuta kachush shetzalo im basar nevela shamein. You know, even if the fatty meat's the treif one, mutar, it's completely permitted to cook these two things in the oven at the same time. My timer, why? Recha ba'almahi, we are only dealing with aroma and aroma alone. V'recha lav miltihi. And it's not an issue. And then the Gemara ends by telling us Levi followed this rule. And he permitted kosher meat that had been cooked in the same oven as pig to be kosher. And again, we spent a lot of time last week. If you didn't have a chance to listen to last week's share, you should do so, as we discussed at length exactly how we process this notion of aroma. But for tonight, why did no one raise the question of Zeya? Surely, Levi... Think about what I just said, right? You have your brisket in your oven. The steam rising from the brisket is meat also. and is now being absorbed into the walls of the oven, not to mention anything else in the oven. So sure, Levi isn't concerned about reicha. He's not concerned about aroma. But why doesn't Levi say, however, when it comes to the Zeah, we have a problem? The Gemara does not mention the concern of Zeah. And indeed, as I mentioned last week, it's Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh, one of the early medieval authorities who ostensibly is the first person to raise this as an issue. Why did no one raise the issue of Zeah within the Gemara in early authorities when talking about this, the challenge of cooking in one oven? And understanding several different approaches, we will talk about five different approaches that have been suggested in order to explain this challenge. Why isn't Zeah a problem in the Gemara? And understanding how this question is answered will provide us with a few, will eventually inform the different perspectives on practically what we do with our ovens. So the first source, again, is not on the source sheet, but is by Rabbi Yaakov Bruchin, who lived in the 19th century. He is one of the most famed products of the Volozhin Yeshiva, and he's the author of Responsa Mishkanot Yaakov. And he just basically outright dismisses the validity of Zeah as a halachic concern. His argument is more complicated than I'm about to paint it, but broadly speaking, the reason Chazal didn't mention it in source number four was because it's not a thing. And therefore, just as it wasn't a thing for them, it's not a thing for us. We don't need to worry about Zeah at all, argues the Mishkanot Yaakov. And even though he is, again, a very respected halachic figure, I would say the broad consensus is not to agree with his opinion, especially coupled with how I began this year, which was, you know, seemingly the concern of Zeah is fundamentally legitimate. But nonetheless, one approach it's important to recognize is just to outright dismiss the concern of Zeah as a legitimate one to begin with. The second approach is by the Aruch HaShulchan Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein. We'll read the source in a second, but once again, I know I quote the Aruch HaShulchan a lot, and the Aruch HaShulchan is, again, no matter how many times I feel like I talk about how amazing the Aruch HaShulchan is, it bears repeating. Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein lived 19th, early 20th century, was a rabbi in Russia, only one of two rabbis to ever write a complete code of Jewish law, the other person being Rambam. And in general, the Aruch HaShulchan has so much. It's just a wonderful, wonderful code for reasons that we won't go into. He has kind of been eclipsed by the Chafetz Chaim, the Mishneh Berurah, but the Aruch HaShulchan methodologically has a fundamentally different perspective than the Mishneh Berurah. And he is a fascinating figure for so many reasons. But in source number five, he addresses the concern of Zeah and writes the following. V'hinei bedin Zeah. Regarding this law of Zeah, mitbara lanu mimishnah de machshirin, that emerges from this mission in machshirin, if you saw in source number two. De lo shayach Zeah ela bimkom hamukaf. It is only a relevant concern in an enclosed, tight space. Velo bimkom galoy, and not in an open space. Kamo, so he gives an example of what is a tight space. Kamo bekira, shehakadera hatachtona natunaba. So you have an oven that is so small, you have the pot placed on the bottom. Va'alaha omed ha'elyona, and above it, you're literally sticking another pot just on top of the bottom pot. Va'ola hazeah saviv saviv, she'en la makom latzeit, and there is therefore no space for the Zeah, the steam, to ventilate. Aval, bimkom galoy, in a large space, kebatanu rim shelanu sheyesh avil, such as our ovens, which contain much space. Again, Rabbi Chaim Chalepstein, right in the end of the 19th century Russia, hazeya ola ba'avir, the zeya goes through the air, ve'ena osa hakadera hasamuchlo, and does not prohibit the pot that is on top of it. So again, the Aruch Shulchan is still actually talking about a scenario we can't even imagine, which is cooking two things at once. He is essentially taking issue with source number three, the Shulchan Aruch, who says that the Zeya infects, contaminates the pot above it. The Aruch Shulchan is saying, well, that doesn't apply to essentially a large, well-ventilated enough oven. By the way, I don't remember if I mentioned this last week. All modern ovens are so much more, you know, well ventilated than anything throughout previous history, right? Our ovens are all incredibly well ventilated for a variety, whether it's a gas oven or an electric oven, they are all incredibly well ventilated. And the point is, yes, can you have situations where you open the oven and steam is just, you know, everywhere? But it is, I mean, admittedly, I'm not much of a cook, so maybe it is commonplace. But the point is that there is a tremendous amount of ventilation and space in ovens. And so what the Aruch HaShulchan essentially easily extends to is the fact that if our concern is the zeya from the brisket, which is meat, is going to contaminate the walls of the oven and render them meat, well, that's only in a situation where the zeya has nowhere else to escape, and therefore it's almost funneled in to a very, very tight space, and it has nothing to go to but the walls. But in a large oven, such as ones being described by the Aruch HaShulchan, and such as ones by our own, which are larger than most people could ever have imagined for most of human history, the zeya essentially is not meeting the oven with any significance. It's not, it will dissipate, it will ventilate, it's not concentrated enough. The Aruch HaShulchan's argument fundamentally is, yes, Zeya is real and a terrifying halachic concern if your oven is small and unventilated. In other words, if you're living in the medieval time, problem. But if you're living in the modern world, not necessarily something that one needs to be concerned by, such as the Aruch HaShulchan's answer. And it's source number six, the Pitchei Teshuva. So the Pitchei Teshuva is written by Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Eisenstadt, but it's not actually Pitchei Teshuva that we are quoting. We are quoting the Pitchei Teshuva is basically, it's a fast, I think this is one of the works of Shechter, says is one of his favorite halachic works, because basically the Pitchei Teshuva is a, just like quotes a bunch of different sources relevant to a given issue. So the Pitchei Teshuva quotes the Prima Godin, Rabbi Yosef ben Meir Ta'omim, who was an 18th century German rabbi. He wrote what is called a super commentary, which is far less exciting than it sounds, but it's basically a commentary to commentaries. And so the Pitchei Teshuva says in source number six, or the Prima Godin says in source number six, the following. So the Pitchei Teshuva points us, Ayin b'Prima Godin, and he cites the Prima Godin at length, skipping his citation. What does the Prima Godin say? Shekatav deBarambam Perek Zayin Mitumat Ochlin Din Dalad. That if you actually look at the Rambam, the Prima Godin invoked the Rambam, the Davka Zeyat Mashkin Kamohu. That the problem of Zeya is only relevant when it comes to liquids. Aval ochlin kamo chelev hamhutach. However, foods, even such as melted fat, in other words, it's not a liquid, ein zeyato kamohu, it does not produce zeya. In other words, if you are cooking a roast and there is no liquid in there, and you stick that in your oven, the concern of zeya just doesn't exist. That the concern of Zeya, according to the Prima Godin, is only ever an issue when liquids are involved in your oven. So again, we'll have to figure out how this view would imply practical halacha, but ostensibly, if you only ever cooked dry foods in your oven, and even melted solids, but you never, again, I can't imagine such a scenario, but you would never have to worry about Zeya. So for the Aruch HaShulchan, Zeya is practically irrelevant nowadays. For the Pidchei Teshuvah, Zeya is situationally irrelevant. You can have plenty of situations where Zeya becomes a problem, but the actual concern is only relevant when it comes to liquids. This view is taken by Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was, you know, one of the most prominent, he was the most prominent rabbi of 20th century Orthodoxy. And Rav Moshe Feinstein has a variation on this. So he says the following. Vihine imlon itbashel betanur kederat bedavar lach. If you're not cooking liquids in the oven, ela sha'afo or bishlo devar yaveshim, rather you're baking or cooking dry foods, shehim ochlin below mashkin, with no liquids, and then those ellipses in source number 7 is where he basically quotes the Prima Godim's opinion. Umikol makom lema'asa bevadai heziu yesh lahachme. So what Rav Moshe says here is that if there is still visible steam, you should be stringent. Rav Moshe is essentially saying it's an empirical question. The Prima Godim is making a claim that only liquids produce steam, and Rav Moshe Feinstein is saying maybe that's not true, but there's a very easy way to solve that problem. If steam is emerging from the food, you should be stringent. Aval bistama ein lachush l'shama heziu b'dvarim yaveshim, but in a regular situation, you don't need to worry that these dry foods are emitting steam. Again, if you're cooking a roast, there's no liquid. If you don't see steam, you don't need to worry about the steam that you know doesn't exist. Umuta b'stama b'zarech hazar, and therefore, in such a situation, you know, the roast had no steam. You can take it out and you can put your mac and cheese in there right away. Even though we have a lot more to discuss, this is actually the end of the source sheet, so I'm going to stop the screen share at this point, even though we have a lot more to get through, because as I talk about the actual practical solutions, either we've kind of already seen them or they are quoted. They are the opinions of people, but not necessarily explicitly written down. But that was the Rav Moshe's opinion. So Rav Moshe's opinion is a variant on the Prima Godim. Aruch HaShulchan doesn't think it's practically relevant nowadays at all because of our ovens. Prima Godim thinks it's only an issue with liquids. Rav Moshe Feinstein thinks it's only an issue with liquids and steam producing dry foods, but otherwise you don't have to worry. The final opinion I want to share is the opinion of Rabbi Yaakov Lobebaum, who was the chief rabbi of Lisa, which is Leszno in Poland. And he died in 1832. And he is the author of the influential commentary Chavat Da'at. And he limits the challenge of Zeya. It's only a concern when it comes to steam rising. The reason the Gemara never mentioned it in source number 4 is because we have foods next to one another. And that's not how steam works. So the first point he makes is actually a fascinating one, which is just Zeya isn't an issue when you have even the brisket and mac and cheese uncovered next to one another, because steam rises. It's only if the mac and cheese is above the brisket or the brisket is above the mac and cheese that we have an issue of Zeya, because by definition, it has to be, we're always talking about things on top of one another, never side to side, because that's how steam works. And finally, the other thing he adds is basically that Zeya can't extract. So in other words, let's say you have your brisket and now the meat steam has risen and gone into the oven. Fine. So now the top of the oven is fleshik. And now you put in your uncovered mac and cheese. So now you have mac and cheese steam, cheesy steam rising. Says the Chavadat, that steam, the cheese steam, can never extract the meat. In other words, the meat and dairy aren't really meeting ever. Yes, you could have a problem. Right. Well, if you were to stick something to the roof of your oven and cook it that way, which I don't know is possible, but let's just imagine that could be a direct problem of, you know, that would be like cooking on a frying pan. But fundamentally, says the Chavadat, it's very hard to come up with situations where the Zeya is genuinely presenting a halachic challenge. And so there are a variety of different opinions when it comes to Zeya and fundamentally how we treat the concern of Zeya, coupled with how fearful we are of, or how attentive we are to some of the stringencies surrounding the concept of Reicha aroma, fundamentally impacts how we cook in our ovens nowadays. So now if we turn practically. So first of all, again, I don't think anyone ever does, and no one ever should, cook meat and dairy in their oven at the same time, right? Even though the Gemara is explicitly entertaining that idea, other authorities seem to often be entertaining that idea. That is something we don't do. But now let's imagine the actual scenario we are more likely to encounter. Your brisket is in the oven. Ding, the timer goes off. It's ready. You now have your tray of mac and cheese. What do you do? How do you cook it? What's the process here? So there are four, I would say, mainstream opinions. At least within the modern Orthodox world, these are mainstream opinions, even if in maybe more of the Haredi and Hasidic world, some of these opinions wouldn't be mainstream. But the first opinion is that of the Aruch HaShulchan modified by Rav Shechter. So Rav Shechter is very clear. As long as your oven is clean, because that way you don't have to worry about Reicha, you don't have to worry about aromas of anything. And because, and recognizing the fact that your oven is large enough to not present Zeya as a problem per the Aruch HaShulchan's understanding, you can put the mac and cheese in your oven, providing it has cooled down. The reason Rav Shechter wants the oven to have cooled down is nothing to do with Zeya and all to do with Reicha. I happened to be called speaking to Rabbi Wida last week about other questions, and I was like, well, I have you on the phone. And I was like, is your opinion the same as Rav Shechter's? Rabbi Wieder is one of the main students of Rav Shechter. And he was explaining to me what Rav Shechter is Rav Shechter is essentially using the notion of heat in the oven as a proxy for the sense of aroma. So if the oven's still hot, we assume the Reicha's still going on, and we are somewhat stringent to be concerned for that. So what do you do? If your brisket's just come out, so according to Rav Shechter, you turn off the oven. If you don't, say, have small children around the house, you could even prop open your oven to really increase the temperature cool down. But if you have, you know, small children in the house, that is not advisable. And basically, once your oven is cooled down, boom, you can put your mac and cheese in there and you're good. The only other caveat Rav Shechter has is he is sensitive to a term we came across last week, which is hevel, which is thick steam. But again, that's kind of, again, just like, again, make sure there's nothing in the oven, right? Just make sure the oven is clear and clean and cool, has reset back down to zero, and boom, you are good. You can stick that mac and cheese in. Zeh achar zeh is effectively applicable, providing you've had a cool down. Interestingly, Rav Shechter often encourages, he said it explicitly to rabbis. He encourages rabbis to encourage their shul members to generally follow the Aruch HaShulchan, because he tends to be far less stringent than other authorities, and he thinks the Aruch HaShulchan often makes a lot of sense. Also, and this fits with the Aruch HaShulchan's methodology, because the Aruch HaShulchan's big methodology was to defend the practices of Eastern Europe. This was undoubtedly the way lots of rabbis in Eastern Europe kind of lived in their kitchens. So the first view, the Aruch HaShulchan / Rav Shechter, is you can cook your brisket uncovered, take out the brisket, make sure it's clean, let the oven cool down, and then stick your mac and cheese in uncovered and boom. That way you don't have to worry about Reicha. We're not worried about Zeya due to the ventilation and space in the oven in general. And there you go. Bob's your uncle. It's all good. Second opinion is that of Rav Lichtenstein. So Rav Lichtenstein, who was one of the Rosh Yeshiva Yeshivat Haaretzion on the Gush for a long time, and also the son-in-law of Rav Soloveitchik, and also a contemporary and very close with Rav Shachla. So first of all, Rav Lichtenstein stresses that the view of the Aruch HaShulchan / Rav Shechter is eminently correct. In other words, if you are, let's say you're going, Shabbos, this would be trickier for Shabbos reasons, but let's just say you're having dinner by someone on a random Tuesday evening, and they are, you got there early, you've got there 45 minutes early, I don't know. And so what you do is you watch them, you see them preparing dinner that you're about to eat, and you watch them, take out the brisket in the oven, and then you watch them wait for it to cool down, and then they stick the mac and cheese right in there. Rav Lichtenstein insists that is a perfectly halachically legitimate approach, and you should never think that that is a problem. However, Rav Lichtenstein himself encourages people to be more stringent, and says that you have to do one of two things. Either you have to wait 24 hours between cooking meat in your oven and cooking dairy in your oven. This is for other Hilchot Kashrut reasons, but fundamentally after 24 hours, all of the concerns are rabbinic. And once we're dealing with rabbinic issues, there's less reason to be worried. Now, obviously, if you were hoping to have mac and cheese that night after cooking your brisket, the whole waiting 24 hours thing, not particularly practical. So the other solution, says Rav Lichtenstein, is kasher your oven. Now, I know what you're thinking because you've kashered an oven for Pesach. Kashering an oven for Pesach involves putting the oven on self-clean and letting it self-clean for who knows how many hours. And you have to open every single window in your house because the kitchen gets so hot, and that's still not practical. But no, because Rav Lichtenstein has a, what we might say is a different definition of kashering your oven for this purpose. All you have to do, clean your oven / confirm it's clean. And second, run it on its highest temperature for an hour. That's it. So you're essentially adding, an hour plus the preheating time for it to get to its hottest temperature. Though you don't actually have to wait for it to cool down. So in theory, you could just take your brisket out, crank the temperature up to the highest temperature possible, beep, 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 your oven confirms it's reached its highest temperature, and then you let it for an hour, and then when the hour's done, your oven has now been kashered. This was, in general, the kashering view of Rav Soloveitchik, even though, again, we would never, we don't otherwise use this as a kashering rule, but I might suggest, I don't know if Rav Lichtenstein says this himself, but I might, suggest that in a sense, this is a stringency. And so when it comes to a stringency, because we still recognize the halachic legitimacy of Rav Shechter and the Aruch HaShulchan's approach, so we're being more stringent, so we don't need to kasher our oven to the most severe degree, the most intense degree, just, highest temperature for an hour. Alternatively, wait 24 hours, and then you never have to worry, which again, broadly speaking, is impractical, though could lead to, Shabbos would be the one time where that's, you've cooked meat in your oven on Friday to prepare for Shabbos. Shabbos is over. You could go straight away and cook dairy within it. Wouldn't be a problem. In theory, you could probably actually map it out. But, if you were the kind of organized meal prepper, you could probably actually plan out enough cookings of meals to even account for this 24-hour rule. But that is Rav Lichtenstein's approach. The third approach is that of Rav Moshe Feinstein. And this is probably the best known approach. And again, it's the approach that I think most people assume to be the correct and only Torah true approach. But it is basically, you have to decide which gender, as it were, your oven is. Which, so you cook brisket in your oven. Now, ostensibly, you could obviously always kasher it, though maybe to a higher standard of kashering. But let's just say your oven is meat. You know, you cooked brisket in your oven, and now your oven is meat. What do you do about dairy? Very simple. Just always cover it. And if it's always covered, there's the recha ain't getting in there, the zeya ain't getting in there. And this is, I would say, the standard approach advocated by a lot of rabbis and the approach that's become very popular in America. You decide which, you know, gender, as it were, your oven is. And whenever you cook things of the opposite gender, you cover them. That's it. That's the third approach. The fourth approach, and I'm laughing to myself because of I'm reading my own notes, which is the approach of Rav Fievel Cohen, who's a prominent rabbi in Brooklyn, and also the Minchat Yitzchak, who's a prominent rabbi in Manchester, who basically always everything is prohibited. But again, if we think of our scenario, you know, you've just taken your brisket out, you want to eat mac and cheese. So as I wrote in my notes, you're never eating mac and cheese. You need to go out and buy a second oven. This is the approach of the Badei HaShulchan and also the Minchat Yitzchak, that basically it is impossible to navigate the halachic issues surrounding Recha, surrounding Zeya. It's way too hard to be certain you're going to get it right, that you're not going to do something wrong accidentally. And therefore, for that reason, have two ovens, have a meat oven, have a dairy oven. Rav Fievel Cohen also thinks you should have meat and dairy, separate meat and dairy grates for your stove top, which is not a thing advocated by anyone else, because it also, when you think about the halachic notions here, just doesn't actually, like, it doesn't seem to fit with most of the things that we have seen. But nonetheless, that is the final approach. You always, always, always need two ovens. So there are our four approaches. You need two ovens. Practically very, very hard, unless you happen to have a very, very spacious kitchen. There's the Rav Moshe Feinstein and the Rav Lichtenstein, semi-inconvenient, but, you know, simple workarounds. And then there's the Rav Shechter / the Aruch HaShulchan, which basically make using an oven for both meat and dairy, obviously not at the same time, a very, very simple, effortless, non-challenging, navigatable situation. I am happy to, in private, speak to people about, you know, specific scenarios, but I'm happy to say publicly, and again, I kind of maybe already gave this away, Rabbi Wida follows, you know, Rabbi Wida, my Rebbe, follows Rav Shechter. And, you know, so even in our house now where we have two ovens, we still, you know, follow the view of Rav Shechter. We use our second oven, you know, for very, very rare situations when either we want to cook two things at the same time, you know, like, I don't know, like, it's before Yom Tov, and Ruthie is wanting to cook both dairy and meat, so then we use the second oven, you know, for one, the first oven for the other. Or let's say, on the rare occasions that I am cooking, I am very attentive to, like, temperatures that are listed on packages of things, and I will refuse to cook two things that are supposed to be cooked at different temperatures at the same temperature. So then I'll use a second oven, because that's the kind of neurotic person that I am. But fundamentally, our main oven, our prime oven, providing it is cooled down, providing it is clean, will be used to cook whatever is being cooked within. You know, covered, uncovered, what dictates covered or uncovered is the recipe, as opposed to halachic considerations. Interestingly, someone, I did once hear another rabbi point out that part of the reason Rav Shechter is very, very insistent on the view of the Aruch HaShulchan is not just because of its halachic correctness, but the simple fact that he lives in a small apartment in New York. And so, you know, you're not having two ovens and glorious amounts of space. Like, Zeh Achar Zeh just becomes the practical reality that he faces. There's nothing wrong, obviously, with any of the other approaches. If you want to be stringent, be stringent. Even if, again, I think I said this at the very beginning of the series, a Judaism which demands the only way to live a correct halachic life is by owning two ovens is, I think, financially unsustainable. And, you know, there are many things to be an Orthodox Jew which are expensive and, to a certain extent, we don't have a way around it, such as schooling and the price of kosher meat and these sorts of things. So at least let's try to reduce the associated cost. You know, we can't have a Jewish world where if you're not, as much as, you know, it's every Jewish mother's dream for their child to be a doctor. But like, you can't have a thing where if you're a doctor, not only is that like the only way you can afford things, but even still, you know, you might be struggling to make ends meet because you need like 17 different ovens in your house, you know, for a variety of different situations. It's unsustainable. The two other things that I just want to stress. That one is, you know, again, people who, and this is what I really like about kind of Rav Lichtenstein's approach, is even though he's more stringent, he has, you know, the intellectual humility to recognize Rav Schacht is still correct. And I think that's something that's very important and often in the world of kashrut can be tricky, because there are some things in the realm of kashrut where definitionally, if you see someone doing something which is, you know, treif, or something which is unacceptable in the halachic world, that creates huge problems. So it's actually really important for us to understand these sources to recognize that, you know, if you were to see someone, you know, take some chicken out of a frying pan and then throw some cheese in that frying pan, and you might be like, I can't eat in this house again. You know, that is the reality of being a from Jew. But if you were to watch someone, again, follow Rav Schachter's process for using an oven, you know, it's important to recognize, again, even if that's not what you would do yourself, that is still eminently kosher. And so it's so important for us to understand and appreciate the difference between when we draw the line between prohibited and permitted versus when we draw the lines between different people's halachically legitimate opinions. You know, and this relates to something, you know, I spoke about this the other night in the share I gave on hair covering. But there's also, I think, a certain level of, we are all inconsistent. We are all frummer in some things than others. That is what it is to be a spiritually striving Jew, right? Which is, we're just not good at all the things equally right now. But there is a big difference between being inconsistent and being illogical. Being, I don't know what the word is, but there is a difference between, you know, being more stringent in the conduct of your own kitchen kashrut, while not so stringent or halachically sensitive in other areas, which is just normal Jewish life. But there's a difference between that and, again, questioning the kashrut of people's kitchens because they are following legitimate halachic opinions that you yourself don't subscribe to. And again, that's why I just think it's so important to stress, understand, and appreciate that the halachic legitimacy of even the more quote-unquote lenient approaches, because again, as we've seen, fundamentally, Recha and Zeya are real halachic concerns, but are nonetheless concerns that are easily circumvented, easily not a major issue. Relatedly, again, remember, Chazal are always talking about a situation when two things are being cooked in the oven at the same time, and that tends to be the creator of most of these concerns, something we don't deal with. Finally, and this is maybe a bigger share for another time, but this cuts to the question of what exactly is a stringency? Because one way of viewing a stringency, and this was Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Soloveitchik's son, I think he referred to it as something like maximum compliance. I forget the term he used exactly, but essentially one way of viewing a stringency is, I want to follow the most stringent opinion out there in order to not violate, you know, the law according to such and such a person. In other words, the evaluation of stringency's legitimacy, even though, you know, Rav Schachner is this wonderful line, like this wonderful Newtonian formulation, every single stringency creates an equal and opposite leniency. But, you know, one way of viewing stringencies is, you know, there are four different opinions. I should follow the most stringent one so that, you know, even according to this opinion, I'm not doing anything wrong. And that is, I would say, the most popular approach to stringencies. The other way of viewing stringencies and leniencies is really, what is the most halachically compelling? What is the most sensible course of action given the sources? And again, it's very, very tricky to evaluate. But fundamentally, you know, the most stringent opinion is two ovens, because we can't even navigate these issues. And so the question is that true? Do we really need to be that stringent because we're fearful of navigating issues that, yes, admittedly, in this three-part series, we've not done, you know, a true deep dive into all the issues and all the sources, but nonetheless, the reality is that, you know, it seems eminently possible, even if you're not, you know, following the Aruch HaShulchan or Rav Shecher, it seems eminently possible to navigate these issues. And so part of the question also cuts to, under which situations do we just follow the most stringent opinion versus follow the most sensible and internally logical positions? And that rarely equates to stringencies. Like, I'm not saying we should never be stringent or we should never be lenient, but perhaps, you know, our choice of when to be stringent, when to be lenient should follow what makes the most sense versus, you know, just picking things because we do.